I've been having too good a time, you know. I appreciate very much the visiting and being among friends. It's been a deep joy for me. When I was doing my graduate work, one of my great teachers was a Swedish theologian whose name was Gustav Wingren. And Dr. Wingren used to say this, it's not often noticed in the stories of the miracle accounts that Jesus, when he had given eyes to the blind, legs to the lame, ears to the deaf, told them to go home. He didn't send them all over the world, though he did that later, but he sent these people home. Part of world mission is world mission. That is reaching out across the globe to make disciples of all nations. So that we are living in a time of Pentecost where the scripture is being translated and where new Christians are popping up all over the world. But part of mission is also going home. And that has been particularly important to Lutherans. Luther believed that the Christian mission begins in your house, at your table, with those lovely enemies, your children, your spouse, your parents, those adversaries whom you dearly love, couldn't possibly get along without, but sometimes can barely stand. I mean, the love of your enemies begins right there. So while Johannes has so beautifully addressed world mission following on the discussions last night, I'm going to turn around and go another direction, and that is home. And I'm going to talk about two kinds of confirmation. Not the kind of confirmation that happens to adolescents at our churches, but confirmation of the witness of the gospel, the kind of confirmation that happens, first of all, in our families, and secondarily, as we begin to leave, as our kids begin to leave our families and move out into the community. To do that, I want to tell you a story. There was a young man who fell among lawyers, and they beat him and robbed him and left him for dead, right? My wife was a perfectly normal French teacher when I married her, and then she became a lawyer and served at the bar for over 25 years. She was the first woman partner in a couple of major law firms. She did extremely well at it. But she got in the habit of bringing home lawyers, her friends. And so I became a companion of these people. It was really interesting. Cynical, hard-bitten, money-oriented, but empty. I mean, I had my own mission field. One of the most interesting thing about it for us was that many of her colleagues were Jews, and we became friends, close friends, with some Jewish families that I would not have otherwise known. And Lutheran pastors don't generally have close Jewish friends. This is a difficulty. One of my teachers was a great Jewish rabbi. He always said, nesting in my Lutheran, so that I knew it wasn't a desirable quality. So we got a chance to go to some, got invited several times to bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs. Have you ever been to one? These are great festivals. Boy, if you ever get a chance to go, you should diet the week before because... I mean, I loved them. Oh, I was like a grasshopper in a field of wheat. Boy, I went from one end of the table to the other practically. It was fabulous. The food was magnificent. There were two very interesting customs involved. In one, the child who was going through bar mitzvah for a boy or bat mitzvah for a girl came forward and stood with the rabbi, and the rabbi took the child's hand, usually 12, 13, 14, took the child's hand in his and pointed the Hebrew text. That is, they gave the text its turn. Secondly, one member of the family stood and told defining stories about the child, oftentimes quite humorous, sometimes poignant, to the congregation, so that the child's deepest characteristics were entrusted to the community. Now, what's happening here? Here's an historic minority that has lived at the edge of our cultures in the West since they came into Western Europe. Here's a historic minority that's lived at the edge of American public life, even here in Los Angeles, where there is such a very large Jewish community. Still, it's fairly well enclosed. The borders are a little more fluid. Yet, it's a separate community that has oftentimes been, as you know, under deep persecution. My wife and I read a book this summer called Bloodlands, which describes the war that took place as Hitler determined to move east into Russia. Over 21 million killed, Jews and Polish and countless others, Ukrainians, suffering enormously through this. Well, we know this, the history of Judaism, as a history of being an oppressed minority. Judaism has learned to survive and thrive on the edge. And we have a lot to learn from them at this point because we, in fact, have become a minority. We think of ourselves in American public culture as being a majority. And so if you listen to the rhetoric on the radio, you hear over and over and again references to us as a Christian nation. In fact, that's simply not true. We're a nation of all kinds of religions and all kinds of people. We as Lutherans, if you go to Perry County, Missouri, or to southern Illinois, or parts of Indiana, or you go to Minnesota or North Dakota, you'll find Lutherans everywhere. But even there, Lutherans are a minority and a dying minority that is no longer able to perpetuate itself. That's simply disappearing. The sociology of the small towns on the plains, which we remember, is the sociology of the inner city. So that if you go to my hometown, Granora, North Dakota, you'll recognize the sociology from Watts in my little village. Things are changing dramatically, and of course, typically as Lutherans, we're 20 years behind the times and dealing with other issues as this huge sociological transformation is taking place. Some years ago, Richard Koenig wrote a fabulous book called A Creative Minority, in which he began to point out ways in which we can make the transition from our assumed majority position into a minority position. That is, we have to learn to think about our church the way Jews have thought about the synagogue, That is, we have to learn to think about our faith from the perspective not of a powerful and privileged majority whose faith is being reinforced every direction they turn. We have to learn to think as a minority that's under siege. This is what's happened in the ELCA. Believers who confess are no longer welcome. We have been publicly told this. Those of us who have insisted on keeping our ordination vows are being thrown out for doing so. And so we are being excommunicated for confessing. Can you imagine? I mean, what a joy and what a privilege. I mean, finally, you know, I get my chance to stand with the martyrs and confessors and say, I will not buckle. Huh? I mean, this is a incredible gift, you know, because our minority status is being confirmed. Now, how do you begin to think like a minority? When you think you're like a majority, this is what you do. You send your kids to school and expect that what you hold will be reinforced by what the school teachers hold. Do you do that here? You don't expect that here. I mean, you know very well why homeschooling has just taken off like it's been hit. Because what the school teaches is very, very much different from what we hold in the faith. This means that our first confirmation, our primary witness, has to happen in our homes. That is, it has to happen among those who are closest to us. Now, this is the oldest Lutheran form of evangelism. That is, the evangelism that takes place from parents to children, from grandparents to grandchildren, from aunts and uncles to nieces and nephews, the evangelism that takes place in the context of a family. Now, you in Los Angeles, you know better than the rest of the country how the stresses that have been placed on this. I grew up as the son of a pastor, visiting my grandparents occasionally, keeping in touch with them by mail and by telephone, occasional phone call. In the old ways, the grandparents and the grandchildren lived under the same roof. Uncles and aunts were right there. I saw bits and pieces of it myself. My grandfather taught me Luther's small catechism while I stood between his knees on a John Deere B, plowing, raking hay. So I still remember the catechism to the beat of that one lung Johnny. Huh? But. I could do the catechism on that beat through and through. Huh? When I was confirmed myself, I didn't know he was coming. I was standing at the front with all the other kids being catechized when I heard his voice. I want Jimmy Nestingen to recite the second article of the Apostles' Creed and its meaning. Boy, I tell you, I suffered a panic attack because he had taught it to me. And I knew I was going to have to stand in front of everybody and recite it, you know. Then when I was confirmed, he stood beside me and we confessed our faith together. You see, I was his evangelism field. You know, his goal was to convert me to the gospel and to hold me in it. And my whole family was arranged that way so that uncles and aunts. Now, what do you do when there are no grandparents? When there are no uncles and aunts? When you barely know your neighbors, huh? When life becomes adversarial, you know, primary evangelism takes on, or primary confirmation takes on a different form. The question is how we give our faith to the children. Now let me give you some examples of how this can work. This goes back to my home state. One of my students was serving in eastern North Dakota. His confirmation students were getting the plumbing courses in the schools, the sex education courses. And they were, you know, being taught value-free, right? You know, so that you know, they were getting instructions in coupling, but no instructions in love. Huh? And so my student knew an older couple in the congregation who he knew to be very much in love and active with one another, even into their early 80s. He knew because he knew that they were in the habit of saying grace before they went to bed together. You know, kind of wonderful. And so I'm not talking about bedtime prayers here. They said grace before they slept together. I mean, just like they said grace before they ate. I mean, you know, they had been together for, you know, 60 years and still loved one another dearly, you know. So he asked this couple to come and teach the sixth commandment to the kids who were taking the plumbing courses. Do you know what happened? Well, here came this old couple holding hands, obviously cherishing one another, talking about the joy of belonging to one another. The children saw an entirely different dimension than they were seeing in school. They saw a different dimension than they were seeing in their family. They saw a different dimension of life than they ever saw on television. They saw what it means to love and cherish one another faithfully for a lifetime. Well, here's an example of primary confirmation. That is, the gospel is being confirmed. It's being embodied by people who love one another with a group of kids. The family has dropped into the background, but the congregation has provided a living set of, this is what it is to be a minority. There was a time, another time, when we could rely on the culture to support and confirm what we believe. That's not true anymore. Now we provide that confirmation in the context of congregational life, in the context of the community. We bring our children into the community to cherish them and to encourage them in the faith and to, with the word and with the stories and with the relationships that are created by them. And then things start to happen. See? Because we're not looking to the outside, to the sinners, to help us perpetuate the gospel for the sake of faith. We're looking to the inside, to the faithful sinners, to help us perpetuate the faith and to pass the faith on to our children. When we pay attention to the inside, then, secondly, we can begin to pay attention to the outside. Faith is vulnerable. There's a difference between faith and sight. When I know the multiplication tables, they're not going to change. But knowing Christ Jesus draws the attack of the evil one. So that in the context of faith, we know what it is to be brought under scrutiny and under challenge. We have this treasure where? In earthen vessels, to show that the transcendent power belongs to God and not to us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, struck down, but not forsaken, and so on. To live in faith is to live exposed. It's to walk with the limp. It's always to be confronted by unbelief and with the possibility of unbelief. We live in the certainty of God's promise. But living in the certainty of God's promise, we also live in the world's attack. There is a different account of life out there that you can get by flicking on the television set or touching the remote. There is a different account of life out there, fundamentally at odds with what we treasure and believe. And so many of us have the experience of raising children in the Christian faith and losing them as they go out the door. I come from a long line of Lutheran pastors. We have served with joy and with pride in our craft, passing the faith from one generation to the next. My oldest son is an unbeliever. My two oldest grandchildren are not baptized, and they will not be baptized in any foreseeable future. Last Good Friday, we were in Seattle visiting with my son and daughter-in-law, and we took our grandchildren with us to Good Friday service. We have an agreement that we can do this. That's as far as it goes. And so we took them to church, and one of my dear friends, a great pastor in Seattle, saw us, and he came back and he took the children in his arms and took them to the font and held them there to tell them what baptism is, as Mommy and I wept. I mean, it's some of the deepest pain in our whole life. The faith that we have cherished for generations is gone. And so the question becomes, how do we protect, how do we care for people in this transition? See, that's a desperate question. Because, of course, when you live with a minority account in a majority culture, the majority culture does not respect but despises what we hold dear. As those of us in the ELCA have learned, that despising doesn't stop at the door of the church, but now comes right in the door and stands and looks at you and says, no, 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 you dummy. You know, so you know, it's entirely different. Now, how do we do this? Richard Koenig, in this outstanding book, Creative Minority, which of course didn't even sell 3,000 and is now almost impossible to find, Richard Koenig, in this outstanding book, talks about what he calls secondary confirmation. That is, secondary confirmation occurs when a child who has learned the faith at home begins to move out of the primary relationships into secondary relationships, and being challenged, hears the faith confirmed to him or to her. Let me give you an example. When I was in high school, feeling my oats, I was full of unbelief. And convinced, of course, that my father was the most ridiculous man I had ever met. And that my goal had to be to transcend my family, get away from all of this malarkey, and actually turn into something. Ha ha. So I went away to college. And when I went to college, I ran into a teacher. I had to take a religion course, and the teacher in that course was a man named Lloyd Svensby, who subsequently became president of Luther Seminary. He was the first teacher I ever had. And so I thought he was as ridiculous as my father. An intelligent man who had dedicated his life to teaching religion. Ridiculous. And so I came at him armed with all my arguments, convinced I could destroy everything he said, and he just laughed at me. Caught what I'd said, bounced back a question that was even more difficult than the one I'd raised, and engaged me in a conversation in which he confirmed the witness that I had learned at home. That's secondary confirmation. I know Rod has done this for countless people over here. I mean, he's been willing to hear the hard question, and instead of answering it, to honor it and to engage it with the deepest intellectual discipline and to serve people in the midst of rebellion to confirm. This is secondary confirmation. You know, this can happen in other more simple ways. Members of congregations can be uncles and aunts to kids who are on their way out of the house. For example, when kids go away to school, hold their first job, or begin to move out of the orbit of the family, it's very easy for members of the congregation to pursue them. There are old relationships there that are important. Here's an example. 2 weeks ago, I went over to Boise, Idaho, from my home in Western Oregon. When I came to Boise, I met with a group of women at the coffee shop in the morning. One of the women was a little bit past 80, and when she came in, she grabbed me, threw her arms around me, and started giving me kisses. It was fabulous. I loved her. Her name is Susie Lindquist. When I was an intern in Spokane in 1969-70, there was an older couple in the congregation that took me under their wing. Their names were Luther and Katie Fendler. Good names for Lutherans, right? Luther and Katie were our family to us during that time. They were Susie Lundquist's family. What she wanted more than anything else was somebody who knew them to reminisce with and give thanks for their memory. So there we stood, you know, remembering a feisty, faithful couple that had borne witness to us and borne witness to them. We were confirming one another in what we had heard. They had been part of a fun and fellowship club at the congregation in Spokane where I served that had started to meet in 1928. There was one marriage after another that came out of that club. Those people stuck together all their lives. They were there at the baptism of each other's children. They were there at the confirmations. They were there at the weddings. They were there at one another's funerals until finally Susie is the only one left. And she wanted to sit with me and just remember, because those people had been so crucially important. You see what had happened? They shared the faith. They reinforced the faith. they confirmed the faith. Now, it's commonly said that Lutherans have lost two generations of their young, and they're well on the way to losing the third. I think the game is actually over with the third. I've been working with young men and women from the families of the ELCA for the last 40 years. I can tell you this, finding someone who's actually had devotions with a mother or father is nearly impossible. Finding a student that knows the Ten Commandments, the Creed, and the Lord's Prayer is like looking for a needle in a haystack. Because what's happened is the majority culture has effaced the minority, and we've been left with nothing. And so we have to start over again. And we start over again with the children, with our young, by bearing witness to them. What do we have as churches? Well, look around you. We're all what you'd say experienced, right? We've been around for a while. You can tell it in our hair, and you can tell it in our gnarly fingers, and you can tell it in long-term memories. Okay, what we have is the gift of age, and what we have is young people who are desperate for relationships that are life-sustaining. And so we have an opportunity to form relationships with younger people in which we pass the faith. And then we have an opportunity to look carefully at those who are in transition, who are going away to college, who are starting work, who are moving out and moving in, as we say now, huh? Who are going out into a culture that does not receive them affirmatively but seeks to undermine. We have an opportunity to bear witness at the most basic levels of life. One requires the other, right? World mission is our deepest joy. I can't begin to tell you the thrill it's been for me to be in Ethiopia and Tanzania and seeing the faith spill over. Once I was part of the baptism of 348 Maasai people in an afternoon. And when the baptisms of all those Maasai ended, the sky opened out of a blue sky in a little cloud, and it just poured rain. And every Maasai there went dancing and singing for joy. God had confirmed with that rain what had happened in the baptisms, huh? I mean, it's absolutely thrilling. Going home is not so romantic. Going home is going to the people you love and who sometimes more often than not become a crucifixion to you. Going home is going home to those people that have been shaping but also have brought some of the deepest difficulties you've ever known. Going home is going home in the context where you come as a speaker of the word. As one who tells the old story and so shapes for nieces, nephews, kids in the congregation, going home, we can look out to those people who are leaving to go out into public life, and we can serve them in the transition, for by serving them in the transition, we become an essential witness to them that they never forget. Okay, thanks for that, and we'll quit and have, looks like lunch, huh? Is that part of the new schedule? I think so.